You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The gospel is being composed to tell us about the journey of transformation, not the correct stories of Jesus. It is the correct story, but it's much more than the correct story because it's the universal correct story of Jesus the Christ in you and in me and the journey that we go on of transformation and growth.
I feel you waiting while you lie awake for an answer that's not coming.
The Deconstructionist Podcast is produced by Nicholas Rowe at the National Audio Preservation Society Recording Studio in Newark, Ohio.
Follow us on social media at www.thedeconstructionist.com, on Facebook at Deconstructionist Podcast, Twitter at DeconstructCast, and Instagram at Deconstructionist Podcast.
If listening to this podcast has benefited you in any way, or if you have connected with it, or it's resonated somewhere with you, please consider making a donation. Even the smallest donations go to help John and I maintain healthy relationships with our wives and keeps their blood pressure at a healthy level. The donate link is in the show notes, or you can visit our website and click the donate tab. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast, a first ever part two.
Yeah.
Which isn't really a part two, but it's like we needed more of this guy. Everybody needed more of this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. This is hopefully the first of many part twos. So we've got a couple on the schedule that we won't leak quite yet.
Yeah. This is like part two of question mark. Like how many times can we have Dr. Alexander Shaya?
So good.
Back on the show. And we heard you guys on the interwebs, on the social medias, the Instagram, Twitter, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's going, number one, get the audio quality better, which is what we're trying to do on this episode.
We're working on it.
We had some technical difficulties last time Dr. Shaya was on. We're working through this. We're rookies. But everybody said, holy crap, never heard that before. But can we have more?
Yeah, it was kind of like, hey, aliens are real. And then moving on to what we're going to eat for dinner. And it's like, whoa, wait.
What'd you just say?
Can you back that up a little bit? Yeah. Aliens are real. What?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. He has so much to bring on this episode. We know you guys are going to enjoy it. This is not part of a series. Alexander Shaya is basically going to have a place at this table.
Yeah.
Forever.
I lovingly refer to him as Uncle Shaya at my house, and my 2-year-old daughter has started referring to him as Uncle Shaya. She's like, Uncle Shaya. And I'm like, yep.
He's the kind of person that when you spend time with him, even if it is just like this over the phone, as we're doing right now, you feel a healing. You feel a stillness, a peace, a wisdom. You just want to take a deep breath and soak it all in, you know, like the bread soaking up, you know, that last little bit of goodness on your plate at a really nice meal. And you just, man, he's really something special. I'm so glad we've built a relationship with this guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's the epitome of just gracious and kind. And this guy's just got such good stuff to say and to talk about, and this just lifetime worth of work and learning that he's done. And he's just been like bending over backwards, literally. I mean, the guy is still coming out of healing after his emergency surgery, and has just been nothing but gracious to us. So we really appreciate that, and we know that a lot of you really wanted him just to go a little bit deeper, so that's hopefully what we intend on doing today.
Absolutely.
Just getting a bigger taste, and I know I'm excited. I can't wait.
I'm always excited.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But I'm really excited about this. And just, it fits so well. Having somebody back like this fits so well with our whole motif here on the Deconstructionists podcast, because it's about a journey.
Yes.
And there's, you can't say it all on a 20, 30, 40, 50 minute interview conversation.
Yeah.
We always can see more, hear more, taste more. And that is what starts the process of deconstruction, reconstruction, hearing things you haven't heard before. So no matter who you are, be it a religious kind of fundamentalist, tightly holding your tradition, and you're just starting to become a little bit more curious about what might else could be out there, or you're someone that's really more of a humanist, more of a philosopher, a scientist, things like that, but you're spiritually curious, both of you are going to love what this guy brings to the table, because we're going to talk about mythology, Joseph Campbell, the philosophy of those types of things. We're going to talk about just how much that's already in our society, and that looking at a spiritual journey, your journey, you, the listener, your journey is really what we're talking about. And so I think without further ado, if you want to learn more about Dr. Shia, we'll actually have some things in the show notes, but let's roll tape on this sucker.
Yeah. Enjoy, guys. Part two.
Alexander freaking Shia!
A million waves across the ocean. Some were waiting in the wind. A million words left unspoken. Without the places to begin. I'd give my life to stop this bleeding. If you could somehow turn around and free the ghost inside this feeling that was slowly going down. God save the dream we need.
Well, Dr. Alexander Shia, or you like to be called Alexander, it is with great honor and excitement that we welcome you back to the first guest ever to do part two on the Deconstructionist podcast. Welcome, Alexander.
Thank you so much.
Well, and thank you so much. I enjoyed the first hour with you guys, and I'm really looking forward to this one. And hello, everybody.
Oh, you can hear the hellos all over the world right now.
Oh, my gosh.
So I love it. Keep it coming. Keep it coming.
Well, everybody wants to know, Alexander, if you don't mind, how are you feeling?
I am doing much, much better. Actually, we're just past the four-month marker in recovery, and I can sense the returning strength almost daily.
That's so great.
I'm well enough now to be impatient.
Oh, that's a good sign.
I understand that feeling completely. Yeah.
You're recovering that humanity.
Yes.
Yes.
Fantastic.
So, before, those of you who are tuning in to this episode, if you guys didn't listen to the first round with Dr. Shia, pause this episode, go back, listen to that one, and then come back and listen to this one. We're going to take a little bit deeper dive today into the four-path journey, which you, if you don't know what that means, you definitely need to listen to episode one. We'll get started here and
Alexander, I think the best place to start, and one of the things that really stuck with me, and I know with a lot of our listeners, and I think it gave so much intensity, humanity, depth, significance, and weight to what you teach, is because you yourself have gone on an incredible journey from the place that you were raised, the culture you were raised in. You touched on a little bit of that. the first time we talked. Can you talk a little bit more? I'd like to dive deeper into that, a little bit more about your journey. This is a podcast where people, if they're listening to this, whether they know it or not, they're either about to start embarking on some kind of a journey, maybe outside the familiar, outside the comfortable, outside the expected, into something new. And you, more than anyone that I've talked to recently, have just an incredible story. Could you talk a little bit more about your path out of the expected into where you are now?
I think that the place that we can all join together is this journey out of the expected. But my early childhood was somewhat unusual from the United States because I'm the son of Lebanese immigrants. And I grew up in the Eastern tradition of the Roman Catholic Church. And the Eastern tradition is very much about mysticism.
Mm.
So my childhood was, to use the phrase, smells and bells. Worship on Sunday morning would an hour or two or three or four. And it was not about a cognitive appreciation of Jesus the Christ. It was about a felt sense, an intuitive, poetic, metaphoric sense. So, and I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, in the difficult days of Birmingham in the 1950s and the early 1960s.
Wow.
And then I went to the University of Notre Dame, where I had my world blown open. And it, as traumatic as it was and as thrilling as it was, it is really the gift of my life to have had the shell of everything that I thought was true just expand exponentially.
Mm.
But my journey was to go from mysticism to the cognitive and to the sort of logical Western, usual Western way of thinking. And I realize that probably most of the people listening, their journey may be the reverse direction. Having grown up, having been told that Christianity is a lot about dogma and thought systems, to now make the journey to the mystical, felt, intuitive, poetic expression. But when I got to Notre Dame, I discovered that the language that I spoke and the language that most of my fellow students and my professors spoke was different. We were all Americans, but I wasn't thinking the way they were thinking. And I felt like I had landed on an unexplored planet in the galaxy.
Wow.
It was, nothing was making sense to me, at least not in my philosophical and theology classes. So I had to find my way into this Christian world, which wanted to know about the history of Jesus and the personality of Jesus and where he walked and what he did, because none of those were the questions that I grew up with.
Wow.
And the information was interesting, but it didn't touch my heart. It didn't bring me alive in the way that I had been raised. So I was really at a loss until I discovered two phenomenal teachers for me.
Mm.
One in person was Joseph Campbell, who came and taught at Notre Dame every springtime. And the other was Carl Jung, who had just died. But many of the theology professors at Notre Dame were making their way to Zurich and were bringing back to our theological discussions these incredible new ideas from a Jungian perspective.
Mm.
And what both Campbell and Jung did for me is they helped give me the bridge from my Eastern mysticism to the Western thought perspectives.
Interesting.
And that bridge is everything about my work. It's like in the latest iteration of my work is called Heart and Mind.
Mm.
And I really believe that this is what's so critically, I don't know if I want to use the word missing, but needed in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Because our churches, our communities have either been communities of heart or they've been communities of mind.
Mm.
And one or the other, they've asked us to check some part of ourselves at the door. And that's not what this vital creative life is about. I don't want to check my mind. And I don't want to check my heart. Mm. I want relationships and communities and friendships that allow me to bring everything of who I am. So Campbell gave me the metaphor of the journey. And of course, his phrase is the hero's journey.
Yeah.
And I discovered a resonance in that. I didn't fully understand everything that he was saying, obviously.
Mm.
But there was something about the journey that he talked about. I thought, if this is a universal, then it must be in the Gospels. And my first, but because the Gospels to me are so absolutely critical to my way of bringing heart and mind together. And so I keep bringing everything back to the Gospels. So I started out doing what many people did. I started looking for the hero or the heroine's journey inside each text. And it's sort of there. But my discovery, if what I've done is a discovery, is that when you take the four texts as a whole, that each of the four Gospels is one part of this great universal journey to be transformed by Spirit.
Could you just dive a little bit into, give us some language, a little bit of an overview of Campbell's thought for people that, most of us are very unexposed to Joseph Campbell. I was until just pretty recently, and then I've just dove headfirst into, I think I was allured the same way that you are. It looked like a bridge. What about Joseph? Who is he? What about him really set your life on fire in this way and gave you this new revelation?
Joseph Campbell was a mythologist. He was a literature professor at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. But he was a great mythologist, and he started on this journey to read thousands of myths around the world in time and contemporary. And he discovered that there is a journey that's underneath all of these stories. And he calls this the one story or the human story, this journey through all the stories. And there are many ways that he breaks down the journey into sections. And one of the ways that he will talk about the journey in seven sections. And in other parts of his work, he'll talk about the journey in four sections.
Mm.
Just as a first step into Campbell, let's take his image of the journey in four sections.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
He says the first section is when the hero or the heroine hears the summons to the journey. And that this oftentimes comes as a great shock. And sometimes the invitation comes and comes and comes and comes and comes before we finally say a yes. So the first part he names as the summons to the journey. The second part, once you have agreed to the journey, is you face tremendous challenges and obstacles. The third part is what he calls receiving the gift or the boon. You've gone on this cycle of awakening. You've gone on this journey of transformation, and you come to this place. In the midst of the obstacles, you come to this place where you get a huge aha. And the aha has in it energy and a little bit of content, but you don't really know what it's about yet until you make the fourth part of the journey. And the fourth part of the journey is what he calls returning to community with the boon, with the gift. But it's only in the relationship with the community that you really, really learn what this gift is and how it's meant to serve. So the four parts of this great universal journey, he says, that we're making, and we don't make this journey once. We make it over and over and over and over and over.
Wow.
It's like a spiraling cycle through our lives. The first part is the summons to a new journey, a new moment in our life. The second part is we face obstacles and trials. The third part is we get a gift or what he calls about receiving the boon, the gift. And the fourth part is returning to relationship, returning to community with something that we are obligated to give. If we stop the journey at the third part, it all falls apart. It doesn't mature, because you receive something not for yourself. You receive it also for others, and it's in the offering of it to others that you really learn how it is to serve.
Oh, wow.
Man.
I think it's safe to say that you just sold a few more Joseph Campbell books just now.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. There are great books out there, and the Joseph Campbell Foundation now is publishing things that were left unpublished during his life, et cetera. So,
where do you recommend people starting with Joseph Campbell?
Probably Myths to Live By is one of my favorite entry points.
Great.
I know back in college, I had the great fortune to be exposed to Joseph Campbell, the Power of Myth series with Bill Moyers by a college professor that we actually are going to have on, probably in a few weeks, but just amazing. So one of the other great minds that you reference that was a great influence on your work was the work of Carl Jung. And of course, those who listened to the first episode with you know that you studied a great deal of psychology and anthropology en route to the work that you're doing today. And one of the things I think we kind of briefly brushed on in the first episode, but I think it'd be absolutely fascinating to have you go into it a little bit more, is specifically your work with sand play and how that kind of influenced the four paths.
Wow, how much time do we have?
as much time as you want. Thanks.
Well, I had gone to Notre Dame on my way to seminary. My negotiation, my bargaining with my parents was, let me get my undergraduate degree, and then I'll go to seminary for graduate work and forward. Because I was obligated in my family line to be the next in a 14-generation line of priests.
Mm.
When I got to Notre Dame, the psychology department in those years was totally Skinnerian, and I spent a year tracking rats running through mazes, and I was like bored out of my mind. And then where did I discover Carl Jung? It was not in psychology department. The psychology department had nothing to do with him. It was in the theology department.
Wow.
Yes, and because most of the core theology faculty in those years was going off to study in the summers at the Jung Institute in Switzerland. And they were bringing back just this incredible new synthesis of Western thought with Jung's developing of the interior life, and that through the interior life, each of us has a direct access to the divine and to the spiritual. And for me, I will use the great name of Jesus the Christ. So Jung became my way of understanding the mysticism that I had grown up, which had been an unreflective mysticism.
Wow.
Interesting.
And he gave me the categories and the mechanisms and the tools and the practices to deepen it and to bring it and to bring my mind to my heart.
Wow.
So, and of course, one of his great methods was noting your dreams and writing them down and listening to them. And I discovered that it's much more important to write them down and just hold them rather than fully analyze them. People think that you've got to analyze your dream. The dream has an energy in it that if you honor the energy, it will gradually open up and lead you to where you need to go. All right.
Wow.
After leaving seminary, because in those days, seminary was just too dry and too boxed for me. I mean, I'd had this incredible opening with Campbell and Jung, and to go back into a dogmatic formulation was just, it was like a straitjacket.
Yeah.
So I left seminary, and I started doing psychological work. And I actually was on my way. I thought I was going to become a Jungian analyst. But because of my Eastern mysticism, I have this this first at-home place in me, which is I always want to experience something a little bit more than I want to just think about it.
Yeah.
And that's just my way. It doesn't need to be your way. But that's my at-home place for my upbringing.
Mm.
So I went to a workshop in San Francisco during the years I was living there to experience a weekend with something called sand play. And from the moment I walked in the door, I knew that I had found the process that brought everything in my life together. This was the tool. This was the piano or the organ that I had been waiting my whole life to play.
Gosh.
And again, sand play, if sand play is your tool, it's wonderful. If it's not your tool, it's not your tool. So I always want people to, the journey is about finding out your own unique balance and way. There's no one way for any of us.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's great.
So sand play is my way. And what was so phenomenal about this was, and to bring this into a short story, Dora Kauf, the founder of sand play, was trained as a Jungian analyst, which was due to do a lot of analytical work on dreams. But she wanted to work with children. And children don't analyze things in the way that adolescents or adults might.
Mm.
And so she discovered that having children play, quote-unquote play, in a tray of sand with lots of figurines or whatever they want to do in this tray of sand, that what happened in that tray of sand was the very same material in the nightly dream.
Whoa.
And then came the huge shock to her. And this was a total shock because nothing in her Jungian analytical training had prepared her for this. The children were healing. Their symptoms were going away, and they were finding new vitality simply by the fact of the play without added cognition.
Wow.
Wow.
And yeah, that was the wow for me is that in the West, and I'll of course hear this as a person who grew up with mysticism, but in the West, for me, the West thinks too much.
Yeah,
thinking's critical. I want to think, but when you're on the process of transformation, deep transformation, and Mahayana Buddhism talks about this as well, that in the process of deep transformation, if we think too much, we stop ourselves.
Ah,
that the thinking leads most Westerners to anxiety and over mentalizing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it confuses the interior journey because there is a wisdom place inside, and I'm going to say Jesus the Christ inside of you, who knows exactly the journey that you need to go on. And to surrender a bit to that, there's a time later in the journey where critical thought is absolutely essential. But early in the journey, if we try to overthink where we're going, what's going to happen, how long is it going to take, what resources do I need, all of that will stop ourselves.
Mm. Oh, wow. Man,
it's that balancing
that.
Act, to steal your terms, between heart and mind.
Absolutely. And I always caution for myself because I know what works for me. I don't know what works for you, but I really want to encourage you and support you and walk with you to find out what works for you.
Man.
But for me, overthinking is an obstacle at the beginning of a new phase of the journey.
Dr. Shai, or I know you like to be called Alexander. I got to remember that. Sorry. Alexander,
thank you.
You're such a great guy. One of the things I'm curious about is, even though we have to balance the heart and the mind, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but one of the things that I'm experiencing while you're saying that is, it seems like the mind can definitely stop us, but the mind and the rational, the enlightenment, this overthinking, overanalyzing, not only is it a new thing in the history of the world, but it is a luxury. It's usually for more first world countries. It's in a lot of ways, there's a lot of people that have never even had to, you know, experience that pitfall or that trap. And it can be a very good thing. And I know you want to hold them together, but it doesn't seem like the heart What problems do the heart have? If the mind can stop us, are there problems that the heart can bring to the table?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The heart can get too sentimental. In some ways, it can get too precious about my way. And the heart can get into this place of my way has to be your way.
Wow.
And we find that a lot. It's like as humans and as in our spiritual traditions, we forget that the way that I come to spirit is just simply my way. It's the way the door opened for me, that you've got your own way. And so we confuse the door with the journey.
Oh, wow.
And the heart often confuses this because spirit comes to us with such power that we become like recovering addicts who believe that the way that our recovery started is the way that everybody's recovery must start. And so we start out with every good intention because we want to share what we have found for ourselves.
Mm.
But the heart will begin to confuse sharing with, I need you to receive it to confirm my gift. And when you don't confirm it, then I get anxious. And then I start pressuring you. And then it's not long before I've got a knife at either your heart or your mind because you must do it this way.
Mm. Right. Wow. So there is a balance that both need, and that's why your work is called Heart and Mind.
Yes.
That is so beautiful, Dr. Shia. Alexander, if there's one thing I'd love to hear you explain just a little bit more, because it blew my mind, this sand play, you touched on it with the children and you expanded what happened there. What about for you and for, you know, this hero's journey and this four paths? How did sand play become such a revelation to you? And could you explain it a little bit in the context of your revelation and your work?
Right, and it was not long for Dora Koff, and we're talking about the late 50s and the early 60s now. It was not long. She started working with children. Very soon, adults started coming to her and saying, well, can I try this too? Mm. And this was the second shock to her, that it was just as effective with adults as it was with children.
Wow.
And so when I came into Sand Play in the early 1980s, and I eventually became a certified poobah with a great organization, et cetera. But I did a very long 3 years of going to my therapist using Sand Play and making, I don't know, 100 images in the sand and doing this really deep interior journey, which even today, now, more than 30 years later, I go back and I reflect on those images about how they were telling the story of my life that is still coming true.
Wow.
And so much of that journey was, how is Alexander, for himself, going to balance heart and mind?
Wow.
And how is that balance going to serve others as well as certainly serving myself?
Wow.
So, I learned that you do a series of images through Sand Play, and there's an energy and a healing and an understanding that comes right in that moment.
Mm.
But it keeps opening up. It keeps opening up. It keeps opening up. It keeps opening up for years.
Mm.
Maybe decades. Maybe the rest of your life.
Mm.
It becomes sort of in a visual, three-dimensional form, it becomes the spiritual text of your, it became the spiritual text of my life. And then what I was so surprised at and affirmed by was when I went to Switzerland and I was studying with Dora Koff, and we would be looking at the images of other people's journeys, I kept relating them to the Gospels. And at that point, many people kept thinking that you needed a Buddhist path. If you're really going to be serious about spirituality, you needed a Buddhist path. And I remember that one day, as we were leaving Dora's home where we were studying, she pulled me aside and she said, Alexander, she said, your heart is filled with the Gospels. Don't ever forsake that. That's your golden thread to understanding your life and the life of others. And that was another piece that was leading me in the late 1990s, early 2000s, to understanding that the four gospel texts that the church has, the codified canon, the sequence that I name is Matthew, Mark, John, and then Luke, that those four texts are the texts. Not that there aren't other texts out there that have correct stories of Jesus in them, but here's the piece, here's my challenge to today's scholarship. They weren't looking for the correct stories of Jesus. There are a lot of correct stories of Jesus out there. But what having a correct story that doesn't give you the context of transformation is like, it's so less effective. That early Christianity was not about, I want to tell you about a correct story of Jesus. Early Christianity was about, I want to give you the way of transformation. I want to give you the way through Jesus the Christ for you to have your vital, creative life filled with relationship and good service to the world.
That is unbelievable. I mean, that brings together so much. It makes me think, someone that I used to read a lot, and recently I don't really anymore. I've got some problems with his work, but there's one thing that really stuck with me with John Calvin when he wrote the Institutes of Christian Religion. The very, very first section of the Institutes of Christian Religion, he talks about how all of life is summed up in a knowledge of self and a knowledge of God. And those two things coming together. And I hear echoes of that in what you're saying.
Yes.
That is phenomenal. Yes. Okay, so let's keep going. Now we're zeroing. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So because of sampling and because of my Eastern mysticism, I know what a lot of Western scholars don't.
Wow.
That cognition did not lead the evangelists to write these texts. They're writing these texts was doing sand play.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
They had all of these stories of Jesus. I mean, think about a room with, here's an old metaphor, like maybe 1,000 note cards pinned on cork boards around the wall, around the room. and each one of these note cards has got a story or a saying of Jesus on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they did sand play. They, in the midst of their community and their being in a moment of crisis or a moment of change and not knowing the way ahead, Spirit led them to take all of these stories and these sayings, and they played with them, and they created a true story of Jesus's teaching about a particular type of human moment.
Oh, wow.
I'm speechless.
So the gospel texts are not the stories of Jesus. The gospel texts are the story of Jesus teaching us about a human moment.
Oh my gosh.
So Matthew teaches us about how we start a new change journey in our life. The first part of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, hearing the summons. Matthew is the story of Jesus teaching us about here we hear about how we hear the summons and ultimately respond in yes to it.
Wow.
The second part of Campbell's journey, facing the obstacles and the trials, that's the text of Mark. Mark is the story of Jesus teaching us about how to move through our obstacles and trials, not wallow in them, not stay in them, not hold them to us as precious little things, but how to move through them, how to receive them and work with them and move through them. The third part of Campbell's metaphor is receiving the boon, the gift and the new yes. That's the text of John. And the fourth part of the great universal journey is now that we've received this new gift, this new understanding, this new boon, now we've got to go find out how it's going to serve. or what Campbell calls returning to the community with new responsibility. That's the text of Luke and what we call the Acts of the Apostles. And so in the late 90s, this moment, it all came together for me. And the pieces had been there, but it was sand play that unlocked the door when I finally realized, and I'm sorry to my Western scholars who think that you had to argue over these texts to get them the way they are. These texts were like an artist being at a blank palette who is compelled, the picture has got to be this way, and the artist doesn't understand why.
Wow.
He just knows it has to be this way. And that's how I'm seeing each of these four texts came to be. An evangelist was compelled by the Spirit to tell the Jesus wisdom as it was written to a particular type of human experience. And Matthew is written to the experience of how do I face change? And Mark is written to the experience of how do I move through trials and sufferings? And John is written to the experience of how do I know joy and the gift of joy and what's it supposed and what's it about? And Luke is written to the experience of how do I serve? How do I serve wider? So it changes the texts from being about Jesus to rather being Jesus speaking to us about the journey that we're on.
Wow.
Plastic eyes surrounded by a suicidal urge to lose control now and let this go. You're paralyzed, trying just to find a way to learn to sleep alone now that you're on your own. Say the words.
Wow. I love what you said too on, I believe it was on Rob's podcast, about the fact that life is not this linear thing and that we go through all four of these paths simultaneously. Some are more prevalent than others, depending on where you are in your life.
Yeah. Harper actually pushed me when I wrote the book for Harper, The Hidden Power of the Gospel. They said, well, we understand that you're talking about that each one of these paths is in your life at every moment. And that's true. But they also asked me to really focus for a moment, to sort of stand back, like go to the moon and look back at the earth.
Mm.
And I was rather stunned, because even though I'm quite aware of how all four of the paths are together at once, when I look at my life from the early 50s to now, I can see a progression in a sort of macro way. I can see a progression through the four paths.
Interesting.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, that there is a non-linear, this is happening, there's different parts of this journey that are happening almost simultaneously all the time. But then,
yes.
But then there is, if you go to the moon and look back, if you can see the whole thing, there is almost some definition from path one to path two to path three to path four.
There is. I see it in my life. That's all I can. That's the only truth I can speak. I see it in my life.
Sure.
Oh, that's interesting,
man.
If you could, we would really love. You kind of touched on it a little bit in our previous episode. The significance of the number four. Obviously, we see the four paths in the hero's journey, and obviously the four paths of heart and mind. If you could just touch on a little bit about where we see the significance of that number pop up in other places.
Well, yes, and I, of course, I always want to sort of give a caution, because I don't want people to push. There's no perfect number. There's no perfect analogy.
That's good.
But let's think about, at least for us in the West, We talk about four seasons. We talk about four compass points.
Hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And where did that come from? Now, I spent a lot of time in Australia, and the Aboriginals don't have a great esteem for the number four. For them, there are six seasons. And so, you know, these great numbers are always metaphors. But the West has gravitated to the sense of the wholeness of four, the four seasons, the four elements, the four directions. When we go to the Bible, you will see in Genesis that four rivers come out of the garden. You can track the number four through much of the Hebrew Testament and also through the Gospels. So in a Jungian way, we understand that there's something deep in the Western psyche which sees four as a wholeness, as a completeness. But just don't go to the point of thinking that that's the only metaphor for wholeness or completeness.
Right,
right, right.
It's just a very expressive one. It's a very valuable one. It's a strong one. It's a recognizable one.
Right. I mean, I love the number seven. And when we're talking about a journey of transformation, seven is sort of a fullness. It has more specificity than the four. But what I wanted to do with these books is I wanted to help people understand why we have the gospel in four parts.
Yes, right.
Four was the metaphor in Judaism for the journey. And therefore, we as Christians assumed that metaphor of fourness, and it became the guiding thread for the choice of gospel text. And I think we spoke last time about Passover, and Passover is a journey in four parts. I'm a slave in Egypt, and I have to make a new journey, part one. If I say yes to that journey, I go out to a desert, a place of trial and obstacles, part two. I cross the Jordan into the new land, into the promised land, the third part, the boon, the gift. But then we forget it took the Jews 200 years in this quote-unquote promised land before they created a nation. And that the fourth part is I have the potential to actualize a gift, but the fourth part is, will I and how will I? So that four-part journey, which Jews don't see as historical, they see it as something that is ongoing in them. And that came into Christendom. And so our early Christian forefathers and foremothers didn't need to reinvent their understanding of the journey. They just needed to add the aspect of Jesus the Christ and death and resurrection. So when Irenaeus in the second century, Common Era, says the gospel must be in four parts, well, if we're looking for correct stories of Jesus, there's nothing about four stories. But if we understand the Jewish metaphor of the gospel is being composed to tell us about the journey of transformation, not the correct stories of Jesus. It is the correct story, but it's much more than the correct story because it's the universal correct story of Jesus the Christ in you and in me and the journey that we go on of transformation and growth and change and vitality and creativity and love and forgiveness and reconciliation and justice. And that's so much more valuable than just having a correct story of Jesus.
It is so much deeper. It is so much deeper. And I think one of the things that a lot of people who are listening to this podcast will be resonating with, and the next step that I want to take us all deeper, Alexander, is it is more about cognitive certitude and assertion. And it is less about cognitive certitude and assertion, and it's more about entering into something.
Yes. Yeah.
Or realizing that you're already in something, and waking up to that, and being almost awake for your journey.
Yes. Yes.
And that is mind-blowing to me. So then, if I'm hearing you correctly, they connected, you know, that four that Joseph Campbell touched on throughout every mythology, every culture, spanning across all civilizations in time. It's present in Judaism in the shape of four. It's distilled in the Passover, which gave them a sense of cultural identity. And then it's taken to the next level in Jesus the Christ, who comes to us almost, and would I be correct in saying that, comes to us in these four paths, comes to us as the call, comes to us as a challenge, comes to us as a gift, comes to us as a return?
Yes, and in fact, to me that is so important, because if I just have a story about somebody, it's like, okay, how does that relate to my life?
Right.
But when I know that each of these texts is giving me an understanding of the path that I'm walking, and each one of these texts is telling me and showing me the cognitive and the emotional content of that path, and also the practices to move through the challenges of the path. And then it's also reminding me that I have direct access to the power of the Christ who is holding me to do the work. Wow.
Wow. And that you can't remove one of these. You know, we want to rush through one or remove one. Let's talk a little bit. Let's dive deeper into actual, like, applying it to people that are reading this, that are cracking open their Bibles, using your book, maybe getting into some Joseph Campbell or some Jung. Let's talk a little bit about this cyclical reading and actually diving into each of these steps and how we can start to practically become more awake and use these Gospels to become more awake and realize what's happening, even though we're unaware of it.
Okay. you've opened up the ocean.
I'm very excited about that.
And I'm going to take a side road here and come back.
That's fine. Sure.
Because I want to remind or offer or invite people on the Quadratus website. We have the companion guides,
yes,
to Heart and Mind and or the Hidden Power of the Gospel. And what we discovered is if people will read this book in very short segments with one other person and talk about it, that it begins to, the book moves from just information to an interior pathway.
Wow.
And our guides are there as a way of giving you some questions and some way to deepen the material, so that it does perhaps move from mind and then joins heart.
Mm.
I don't want to leave mind. I just want mind to join with heart.
And I just want to remind our listeners that resource that you just indicated is on the Quadratus website. That's quadratus.com, quadratos.com. And it is a free download.
Yeah, the information packet is a free download.
Yes, it is a free download.
And then each guide for each one of the paths is a U.S. $9.99.
Not every penny.
Small price to pay.
and it really helps support my life and support the work going forward, and I'm very appreciative. Okay, let's should we look at the text of Matthew?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or do we? All right.
I think before you get started, I think the thing I'd like to point out about the Gospel of Matthew, that path in particular, I really enjoy this path because I think a lot of our listeners can personally identify with this text, just in regards to how do we face change and the Jewish people at the time feeling like God had completely abandoned them. And I think a lot of our listeners in particular can personally identify with the feeling of abandonment. You know, where's the divine in my life? So, I think if we start there, if you want to talk a little bit about how can we apply this gospel to our lives.
Okay. This gospel opens up by giving us a meditation on Joseph. And Joseph is just such a good guide for us. And I understand that Mary sort of did a lot of the biological work here. and we get her text in Luke. But Joseph is the meditation in Matthew because Joseph is the guy who's busted his butt to do everything the best he knows how. And he's had the good fortune to be married, to be betrothed to this fair, beautiful Jewish goddess. I mean, Mary is not a lowly woman of Judaism because she's in the line of priests, if we read the historical story right. And so this is a powerful marriage between Joseph of the line of Judah and the line of the Messiah with Mary in the line of the priests. And so, you know, our fairy tale says the two of them should get married and everything is going to be happy ever after. Whoops.
Jeez.
So the nightly dream comes to Joseph. And the voice of this dream says to Joseph, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife. Even though, Joseph, if you take her as your wife, you're going to be shamed and shunned by the people closest to you because they're not going to understand why you're doing this. And this is the point about change. Every one of us lives in a tribe of people who love us, but in a change moment, sometimes the people who love us are not our best advocates because they have their own, perhaps, fears and anxieties or confusions about growth, and they will pull back from us when they see us growing. It perhaps might make them feel less. It perhaps might bring up their own growth questions, and they maybe aren't in a place yet in their life where they want to entertain them. It's an exceptional friend and spouse and family member who will hang with us as we move through rethinking and refeeling questions and issues in our life.
Cannot agree more.
And so Joseph here is the metaphor because as the moment Joseph says he's going to marry Mary, he's going to bring shame on his father. And the number one thing that a Jewish man must never do, a Jewish son must never bring shame on his father's name. And so we know the rest of the historical story that Joseph, who is a citizen of Bethlehem, is raising his child with his family in Nazareth, which is the outcast land. Why is he there? Because exactly, when he took Mary, his family shamed him and shunned him and drove him out.
Oh.
So the first thing, and it doesn't need to be this dramatic in our life, and I would say it's probably not this dramatic in our life most times, but we need to be aware that when we start a change process, people around us are probably not going to understand.
And
if we've got people around us who are willing to say, Alexander, go for it. I don't understand what you're doing, but I want to support you doing it. That person is going to be a rare gift for you. Hold on to them. They're a treasure. Most people will sort of pull back from us a little bit just because as we entertain change, it makes them unconsciously feel uncomfortable.
Why is that, Alexander?
Unless you've made a deep journey of transformation, an angel or a dream is knocking on your door that you've not yet received. And when another person starts their journey, that knocking, that interior knocking gets louder. And if I am not ready yet or I don't want to hear that knocking, I'm going to pull away from you because to be around you or to entertain the questions that you're entertaining is going to increase that pressure inside myself.
Wow.
If I'm a listener right now, the first thing I'm asking in my mind is, how do I know if I've been on my journey? How do I know if I've started?
Great question. And the answer will be a little different for each of us.
Sure.
But my absolute first recommendation, have a trusted friend, a minister, a guide, who you can begin to talk this out with.
Mm.
And the talking out with is, don't go into the talking like I'm going to get firm resolution in my cognitive brain. The talking helps us get down into the felt body sense and the heart. And it's the body and the heart that will know first more than the mind.
Mm.
And so the talking is not to get to certitude. The talking is to give the body and the heart a chance to catch up and speak louder.
Man, that is so good. All right, let's keep going.
Which is sort of what must have happened with Joseph. Because, I sometimes in the gospel, I think we see the last part of the story. How many times had Joseph had the dream or the angel?
Yeah.
And I love, in the Middle East, there are these chapels dedicated to Mary. And they tell the story, not told in the gospel text, but in these chapels, they tell the story of how the angel came to Mary seven times before she said yes.
Wow. I think that's so good to hear, because I think there's so many people that wonder if they've missed it.
Yeah.
You know, what happens if I don't say yes? What happens if I don't have faith? What happens if I don't take a step? What happens if I'm paralyzed in fear or misunderstanding?
Yeah, the spirit is a gentle hound.
Beautiful.
Always giving us the opportunity.
The other thing that I really love that you talk about in regards to the Gospel of Matthew is the idea that this gospel is trying to show us that these early Jews are waiting for the rebuilding of this physical temple. And yes. Matthew's trying to say, no, it's not a physical temple at all. It's not a physical place. It's within all of us. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. I just love that.
Well, it's so contemporary for what we're going through right now. We get a new understanding of God. We get a wider understanding of Jesus the Christ, and it leads us into new territory. But as time goes by, as years go by, as centuries go by, we then build a temple there.
Yeah,
and think that that's the end of the story. And the Spirit is always leading us forward, always.
Mm.
The Spirit is not leading us forward by looking in the rearview mirror. And so the Jewish people at this point in their history were locked into the thought that God could only speak to them in the Holy of Holies, at the top of the temple in Jerusalem. And the text of Matthew, and when the text of Matthew is revealed or composed or painted, I like to give that image. When the evangelist paints the text, it's in the days or the years after the temple is destroyed and the Jewish priesthood has been annihilated and the holy city of Jerusalem is deserted. Jews didn't go back into Jerusalem for almost 50 years after the destruction of the temple. It was a ghost town. And most of the Jewish population believed that what they had to do, and I'm going to use the word fundamentally, they fundamentally believed what they had to do was go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. That was the only way that they could secure God's promise to be with them.
Mm.
And this small Jewish Christian community in the city of Antioch, what is today Turkey, through the gospel text of Matthew, heard the deeper revelation. No, we are not obligated to go back and rebuild the physical temple. Maybe God will ask that of us, but we are living now in the presence of a new temple, which is where the community gathers. Where we gather is the deeper voice of Jesus the Christ, our God. And so we, in 2,000 years ago, we move away from the idea that God is located in a particular place on a particular tract of land and heard by a particular person, the high priest. And we are now moving into the time where God is everywhere and everyone has access to that experience. And our temple is relationship, not building. Our temple is relationship with a community of those who know the voice of the beloved. And that can be a relationship of one or hundreds. But Matthew unleashes Christianity to go all over the planet, and now we can say all over the cosmos, and understand that we aren't taking our God anywhere. God's already there. We go to discover.
Wow.
The God which is everywhere. Because when we took God out of the temple at the top of the mount in Jerusalem, that was a revolutionary moment of understanding that God now is in each grain of sand, every particle of stardust, every tree, every creature that swims in the ocean. And so we are not people on earth. We are people of earth. And we understand that Jesus the Christ holds all.
Oh, man. I think it's important to point out that Adam and I are doing our best to stifle joyous laughter over here. So
John keeps shoving a towel into my mouth. Because
Oh my goodness.
To be slightly crass, Dr. Shia, one of the things that we've gotten some critiques for on the show, and it's been impossible while you're blowing my mind right now, is I do these things that people on Twitter called Adamgasms.
Yeah.
And I've had to work very, very hard, but I am just finding everything you say. I just leaned over to John, he took his earbud out, and I said, I could listen to Alexander talk about this all day.
Thank you.
This is so...
it's been a long journey. Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's so refreshing. It just, you know, I think one of the things I love most about this space that we've created that you fit into, I shouldn't say you fit in, you expand
yeah.
so incredibly well is discovery is this beautiful moment when you realize that your world is now too small again.
Yeah.
And there's more and more and more. And that last bit that you just talked about, the Christ being this all permeating and all holding together thing, man, I just don't know anyone that can't at least find that beautiful and fascinating and interesting. We could easily spend another hour just going through the rest of the Gospels. I want people to get your book. I want people to go on your retreats. I want people to get the companion guide. And you've harped so well on the community that needs to be involved in this. I wonder if we could start to wrap up our time a little bit by just giving people some practical pearls that they might find in the book or that might shed some light on how they can take this thing that we have always looked at so cognitively. And you even just shared the story of Joseph. You did it just with that little tidbit in the beginning of Matthew, this underappreciated, undernoticed, underrecognized character of Joseph. And you brought us into it. You initiated us into it. And I started to feel myself resonating with the energy and the vitality just in that. How do we start to crack these Gospels open for our listeners that, you know, wake up in the morning and need some contemplation, or, you know, how do we start to do this? What are some nuts and bolts that we can start to do even now?
I want to give you the first key to what I think is the key to Christianity. Christianity is a relational spiritual path. And maybe that relationship is another human being. I hope in part it's another human being. But I also want to suggest something which is wild and wacky and crazy. If you don't have that one human being, I want you to pick up these texts and go read it with a tree. Read it with your dog. Read it sitting by the water. And read it to those, to the tree, the dog, the water, as a living presence of Jesus the Christ. There is something that happens to us when we read these texts in relationship and understand that everything around us is speaking the text back to us.
I'm having a small stroke. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Here's the thing. Here's what I love about that. For a lot of our listeners who are raised in the church, some of these little mantras start to taste a little bitter when you hear things like relationship. I was always, and this is correct. What I'm about to say is correct, but almost too simple. And when I was young, I always heard, you know, Christianity isn't a religion; it's a relationship, and that's true. But what you're saying is so much more than that. It's not, you're not just talking about ask, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes now, asking Jesus into my heart or something like that. You are saying that when you sit with that tree, when you're with your dog, when you're hopefully with a friend, that the Christ is there.
Yes.
And that it needs to be relational.
Right.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I think the idea of community is something that we've promoted since day one on our show, and how truly important it is because we are born to be communal people. Just what a crucial component that is. So I just love what you said about that.
But and you know, I people are asking me, and maybe I will write the heart and mind journey for a community. But I want to encourage us to be frontier people.
Mm.
We are at a new moment in human history and development. We have never had, until this moment, the idea that community can be a community of tribes. Everything up until this moment in history has been, I'm going to be a community of people that think alike, feel alike, do alike. And what we're now at the point of is entertaining that we can be a community of true diversity, that we can join together to walk the journey, but knowing that everybody's walk is a little different gait and pacing and content and feeling. And I don't have to impose my content on them, and they don't have to impose their content on me, but we can know that we're all walking this four pathway or seven pathway universal journey, and that we can name that journey Jesus the Christ.
But we know we then no longer have to be the same. We just have to be together.
Yes. And respectful. That's the key. We have to be together and to be respectful. I want to learn about your journey. I want to share my journey. I don't want you to make a lot of judgments about my journey, and I'm going to make an agreement not to make a lot of judgments about your journey.
Man.
Oh, that's so good.
Just keeping it practical for a minute, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so if I'm completely wrong on this, just be like, well, Adam, you missed that. but I think maybe just keeping it practical for some of our listeners, that if people are cracking open these gospels, reading your book, we're such a hurried people. We're all in such a rush to get to the next epiphany, to get to the next transcendence, to get to the next feeling of ecstasy, to get to the next aha moment. But it seems to me like even early in our conversation, one of the things that you said is you said on the journey of transformation, if we think too much, we stop ourselves.
Yes.
So we are a hypercognitive people that are also, we have no sense of delayed gratification, no patience, no nothing. Could you expand on that just a little bit in practical application? What are some ways that we crack these texts open in a community, understanding the Christ relationship? How can we slow down? What are some ways that we can not be in such a rush to say, well, I'm not getting anything out of this.
Well, I first of all, I'm going to say something sort of paradoxical, which is for some of us, we may need to just sit down and read the whole book. You want to have some sense of where this guy's going and where this journey is going to take me. But what we first noticed about 5 years ago is I started getting emails from married couples, partners, and they were saying that they intuitively just started reading a paragraph or two of the book out loud to each other and putting it down and talking. And people would write me embarrassed because this had been going on a year. And in one instance, I know a couple who took 3 years to read the book this way.
Wow.
It changed their life. And that was the genesis, hearing that experience over and over and over again. That was the genesis for me to draw together a team and to start writing these companion guides, which was to give people a very simple structure to do exactly this, slow it down, so that we began to actually walk our journey rather than just read about it.
Oh,
that is so good. So incredible. Well, to be sensitive to your time, and we just want to thank you again so much for coming on our show. I mean, as always, you have an open door to come on anytime you feel inspired.
Mm. Dangerous.
Oh, not for us.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I feel like I've learned a ton again. So, before we part ways, where again is the best place for people to go just to get more? I know we mentioned the Quadratus website. Is that the best place to go? You also have a website as well, correct?
There is. The first website is go to Quadratus, Quadratos.com. And we've just done a whole retrofit of it and added a whole new content. A second website is my personal website, which we are in the process of redoing right now. But that's the alexanderjshaya.com. Shaya being S-H-A-I-A. But I would really encourage people, go to the Quadratus website first, and there are a number of links from that website to my personal website.
Okay. And as always...
And I appreciate the invites to come speak and retreats and all of that work. The formalized work that I'm offering is you can find it on the website.
Outstanding. I know we would love, absolutely love to get you in here in the Midwest for a retreat. I think, especially after this episode, you know, having you on twice, I think we'd be able to fill some seats quite easily. So.
Yes. And if and when you take that trip to Notre Dame that you were talking about, we are going to dine and break bread and maybe even invite our listeners
guys from Columbus will dare to go to Notre Dame. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We're breaking down barriers here, you know?
The Buckeyes can just sit down and shut up for a second. And maybe we can even do a little broadcast of Dinner with Alexander where we talk about some fun stuff.
I will look forward to it.
We love you, Alexander. We pray for you and your healing and just what the Spirit of Christ is doing in your journey and how you're inviting people into new and broader spaces. It is just a wonderful work, and we are so blessed to know you.
Thank you. I feel the same, and I send my deep prayer to every person who's listening. May this journey become rich and vital for you.
Mm. Thank you, Alexander. We look forward to doing this again.
Peace. Peace and grace.
There's a girl who waits for me beyond the sea. So keep a slow, steady wind always blowing till I return. They carry me home. You've a heart made of gold I hold so sweetly. You've a heart made for me and me alone. So keep a slow, steady heart gently beating till I return.
Holy nuggets of joy.
Dude, I'm in one way, I'm incredibly glad that we stopped recording when we did. Because I think I was in danger, like medical, like mental health danger, because I was like just having little strokes of joy. But in the same way, I could have listened to him for the rest of the day.
Yeah, and it's a good thing for our listeners that you've gotten so good at editing, because we will at this point have taken out all of our awkward pauses where we're just like picking our jaws up off the floor.
I'm so glad that wasn't a video Skype.
It would have been super awkward.
He would have been like, these guys are weird, man.
This is why we don't do video.
Yeah, video is not good for anyone.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's so many quotable moments that just happened throughout that interview that, I mean, we didn't even really get into the four paths as deeply as we did the first episode. So again, like those of you who are just now tuning in, you need to go back to the first episode that we did during our scripture series. Yeah. So he goes way deeper into that. But I think for our listening audience, for a lot of you out there, I think the little teeny bit of the toe that we dipped in the water of the first path, the Gospel of Matthew, I think is will resonate with a lot of you out there. Just the idea of, you know, dealing with change, specifically feeling that sense of abandonment, you know, where is the divine in my life? Where is God? And realizing that, you know, the temple, so to speak, is not this physical place, but this place that exists within us, and that the divine is found, you know, everywhere. And that, you know, it's not the end, you know, but rather the beginning.
Mm. Man, I think my favorite combination of quotes, his work is called Heart and Mind. And the cool thing that I think he brought out, and the point of this episode wasn't necessarily to dive deeper into the Gospels. That's why we just kind of gave some nuggets and some ideas, but to really provide a deeper understanding overall, and then some practical things overall that people can, because we don't want this to take the place of experiencing his work on your own.
Right.
But the whole heart and mind combination thing, the two quotes that just absolutely provided both rupturing and clarity for me was on this, if we're all on this journey of transformation, and that's what this podcast is about, deconstructing, reconstructing, and sometimes life just deconstructs for you and reconstructs for you. This journey is a place that you find yourself, that you awaken to the fact that you've been on this journey. You're there. And the quotes that I thought were so helpful for that, to tear things down and to build things up, was regarding the mind, as he said, on the journey of transformation, if we think too much, we stop ourselves.
Yeah.
There's a, we call it in business paralysis by analysis.
Yeah.
You just freeze. You start to think too much. And I know there's people listening to this that you're prisoners of your own mind. You're not allowing experience to do its work. You're not allowing, and that's really all the mystical is.
Right.
Is experience. But then he also said the heart can get too sentimental.
Yeah.
Can get way too sentimental. And we all have been the kind of person, and we all know people who are so infatuated with experience, with smells and bells, with ecstasy, with your thing, that you really repress cognition and understanding, and you become scared of it. And when some kind of analysis, some kind of revelation, some kind of realization competes with what your heart wants, that also stalls you out. And so the heart and the mind are almost checks against each other.
Exactly.
As well as being harmonious. That is incredible.
Yeah, it's this beautiful, tenuous balancing act between the two. And it's one of those many instances within spirituality where it's a both and, you know? the two need each other. It's not an either or situation. I think my favorite quote, and I was like furiously trying to scribble this down as you said it, because as you know, we love the idea of community, especially when you're on this type of journey, where he says, our temple is relationship, not building, a relationship with community of one or thousands. Mm. And I'm like, yep. Mm.
And we're a hyper individualistic culture. One of my friends I've made through this podcast is a thinker, theologian, philosopher, leader of people over in Belfast named David Kapaner. You guys should all check out his stuff. He's got a podcast as well, and speaks regularly at a church in Belfast, and he's absolutely incredible. And he talks about how shame, which we all have, everybody's born with shame, leads to isolation. We become individualistic. We become almost hermits of our own way of thinking about things. And that produces a new anxiety, which we then try to medicate with consumerism. We try to collect things, wear new clothes. We try to, become obsessed with lifestyle. We come, and it then produces more shame, which leads to more individualism, which leads to more consumerism. And the thing I loved about Alexander Shaya is he talked about how community and the journey is something that is relational. Even when he was talking about like the tree and the dog and just the fact that this Christness, the divine, is all around you. It's an awareness. It's a waking up.
Right?
Man.
And it goes back. It's so funny. I was stifling my laughter back here. But it goes back to Campbell's The Hero's Journey and that final stage where the hero returns to his homeland. But the key to it is the hero has learned something or brought something back, but it's not just for the individual.
Yes.
It's for the individual to share and to impart upon the community that benefits the community. It's never just about you.
Dude, and if I can just rant for just a second, because this is something that people need to hear no matter where you are. No matter where you are on your spiritual journey, you have probably left a community, whether you've disengaged and you're still just showing up, whether that's your family, your circle of friends, your church, a group, whatever, you start to think that just because I no longer feel like I fit here because I've been called or led or invited into something else, maybe for you that's I've, quote, lost my faith or whatever. Maybe for you, you found faith, and that has now made it very uncomfortable for you with the group that you're around. I think the worst thing that you can do is leave.
Right.
Because the community around you needs your experience. Now, there is a leaving that has to happen. That's part of the journey.
Right.
But I think we rush to the actual leaving of the people around us way too fast when you can actually offer a gift to them in a new way, albeit uncomfortable, albeit strange and awkward, albeit all these kinds of things. There's still a fidelity and a commitment that can happen even though you no longer feel like you fit.
Yeah.
I just wish more people stuck around in my life when they felt like whatever they were now believing or thinking or feeling or experiencing didn't fit into our community anymore. I would have loved to have continued to learn and grow through them.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. When the conversation and the discourse ends, that's where the problems begin. And that's where oftentimes, as we mentioned before, isolation begins, and that generally never ends well. So
no.
Great point, man.
Follow us. If you like this episode, please go out, buy Alexander Shaya's book. He's got like one main book. It's called Heart and Mind. You need to experience this. Read it with friends, read it with a loved one. Let him, in his grace and wisdom and generosity, lead you into realizing the journey that you're already on.
Yeah.
In some really good stuff. Follow us. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. All that stuff. You guys know how to do all that stuff. Participate. This is your space.
And don't forget, Shad, I believe, recently completed those guidebooks as well that go along with the main book, some study guides. So check those out as well.
Check them out. Man.
But yeah.
That's all we got. Thank you guys so much. If you can donate, there's a link in our show notes as well as our website. It helps us do what we do. It helps you become more of a part of it. It pays for all of this and so much more. I don't want to harp on that too much, but we're looking for other ways to incentivize giving. We think this podcast is our gift to you that you can then, you know, give back in return. And this can be a cycle, a beautiful cycle of give and exchange and receive and take and all that kind of stuff. So please do that. $5, $10, $25. Take our wives' blood pressure down a little bit. And other than that, we love doing this. We feel like we're here with you guys.
Right.
And we love you all so, so much. Thanks for all the feedback, suggestions, criticisms, critiques. We look at all of that as a gift.
Absolutely. So thank you guys.
Yeah. We are your hosts and keep deconstructing and reconstructing everyone. I am Adam Narlock.
And I am John Williamson.
Until next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.